Are any questions in the room? Please.
Yeah, this one by the speaker.
My question refers to the source of this illusionary I. Now, Advaita Vedanta, as far as I know, talks about some kind of omni field of consciousness, everlasting, ever-existing, all over the cosmos. Now, what? And this and individual eyes are some kind of waves. Goes up and down. Now, what does Buddha say about it, if he did say? And later, the Buddhist canon, what does it say about this source?
It's a good question. It's one of the interesting things is that the Advaita Vedanta expression, I'm not a great expert in it, but what I've read of teachings of people like Sri Ramana Maharshi, that rather than using the Buddhist expression of letting go of the I am, they rather expand the I am to encompass the entire universe. So, and also you do find expressions in the Buddha's teachings where he says, you know, the wise one, the sage, recognizes that nothing belongs to them, but they also recognize that there isn't anything that doesn't belong to them either. I would say that whether you speak in terms of a universal I, or seeing through the habits of the personal I, that they're both aimed at the same realization. My understanding of it. The Buddha doesn't speak in metaphysical ways very often. Most of his teaching is directed at the sort of the experiential. So over and over again, when people try to pin him down on this sort of having a metaphysical map of the universe, he often will end up saying, I teach one thing, dukkha and the ending of dukkha. So he's more of a clinician than a theoretician. He's like a doctor that will cure your particular illness rather than explain the nature of all disease. So you don't have much in the classical teachings where the Buddha talks about those kind of models, but particularly where the exact source of the I feelings come from, but what he points to is that is ignorance, not seeing clearly, avijja. Through not seeing clearly, then those kind of formations are believed in. They are what you would say they are reified. They're given solidity in a false way because of ignorance. So, in essence, you have the quality of awareness, like Buddha, what we call the quality of vijja, or awareness, knowing, or when we talk about taking refuge in Buddha, that you're, in a sense, embodying that fundamental quality of awareness or knowing. And when that's grasped incorrectly, then we turn that awareness into me. Me, the one who's experiencing, me, the one who's remembering, thinking, doing. So this is what, in the words of the chanting, when it says identification with consciousness, that's what it's talking about, that there's that knowing, but it's being claimed as a separate individual I, or like in the Advaita model, the waves on the ocean of suchness. I feel, you know, my mind moves easily towards the theoretical. I like maps and diagrams and descriptions. But what's very easy for us to do is to spend so much time creating the perfect map and the ideal expression or images that we forget to actually do the necessary work. And so I found probably one of the reasons why I gravitated towards the Dharma practice in the southern Buddhist world is because it is so pragmatic, it's practical, rather than dwelling upon the theoretical, because my mind can go get happily lost in libraries of theory. But what matters is moment by moment, as the Buddha points to, dukkha and the ending of dukkha, seeing where there is disharmony, where there is that sort of duality of self and other, subject and object, in the system, and then recognizing that that dukkha can become can come to an end, that there, that the quality of attunement or realization of Dhamma can be established, and that's the important thing. One of the symbols I often use is to say, and because he's very specifically and deliberately limited what he talked about, and many times people would ask him these kind of philosophical questions or things much more speculative. And then he gave these teachings, like he picked up a handful of leaves from the forest floor and said, what do you think is greater, the number of leaves in my hand or the number of leaves on the trees? Again, loaded question. Well, Venerable Sir, you know, the number of leaves in your hand is very small. The number of leaves on all the trees is very great. And the Buddha said, exactly. What I teach you is comparable to the leaves I have in my hand. What I know and what can be known is comparable to all of the leaves on the trees. And why don't I teach you all of that? Why do I only teach you this small amount? This is what I teach you is what's really going to make a difference. That's what leads to peacefulness, towards clarity, towards liberation. That's why I teach it. Other things I don't teach you because they don't lead to peace, to clarity, to liberation in a direct way. So then what have I taught you? Dukkha. The origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So an image that I use is like if you're playing a musical instrument and you're in an orchestra, you don't have to be able to write mathematical equations for everything that's going on in the instruments in the orchestra. The vibrations in the strings of the violins, or and what's happening to the metal of the big kettle drums. What's going on with the air, move the turbulence of the air inside the trombones, the flutes. You know, you could take a long, long time writing a lot of equations to describe all of that, but you don't need to, because all you need to know is those trombones are going too quickly. They need to slow down, or my A string is a bit flat, I need to tighten it up. We can tell when things are out of harmony, and we can adjust so that then we can bring ourselves into tune, be attuned to the rest of the orchestra. So that's why the Buddha points to this explicit limitation of knowledge. So it's like, and just bring your attention to this one thing, and then all the rest is extra. If you find out other things about the universe and how it works, fine. But if you don't, that's fine too, because what's really important is what we know. There's a few more. Okay, with the white scarf. Then I'll take some from over here. Good.
There is no owner to be found of this body and these feelings, etc. Yet I am the owner of my karma.
Yeah, the reflections in that chant are, in a way, that's at least acknowledging the conventional truth. Where we start off from, not even taking responsibility for what we're experiencing. So that, in a sense, that I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma. So that's the, bringing our understanding, our view into alignment with at least the conventional reality. And so then the next stage is the insight that, well, there isn't really any person that's the owner of the karma, but that's, or that is the doer of the action. But it's those words of the chant are about establishing a conventional understanding or a conventional appreciation. So it's like if you are if you're speeding along the highway and you're going at 150 kilometers an hour, and then the police officer pulls you up and says, you know, you're speeding, and you say, there is no real object, there is actually no car here, and there's no me and there's no you, officer. he's going to give you a ticket. So, first of all, or at least a ticket, if not something else as well. So, the first thing is, okay, drive according to the speed limit. And once you're driving according to the speed limit, then within that, say, being in accord with the sort of conventional relationship, then, okay, to deepen the understanding, you recognize, well, really, there is no person who's driving this car. There really is no car, but these are the,
Is the car working on the conventional level?
Yes. So
That's where it's working?
Yeah.
So what does it mean, the end of karma?
The end of karma, is where there's the letting go of the sense of self. And so as the Buddha describes it, the ending of karma is where the depth of insight is such that every action that's then taken is fully in tune with Dhamma, with reality. And so no actions are being taken that are based on greed or hatred or delusion. And so what's experienced is the flow of the effects of past events, past causes, and a quality of attunement to the present. So the ending of karma is like the experience of an arahant after that their enlightenment. Then they are still dealing with people and walking around and eating and breathing and taking care of things, but also they're receiving the results of their past actions. And so an extreme example would be Angulimala, who was a bandit, mass murderer, before he became a monk. So even after he became an arahant, you know, the families of all the people he killed, you know, still hated him and had a lot of... Some people appreciated, well, he's an arahant now, so we can forgive him. But other people, you know, he killed my mother, he killed my father, he killed my children. And that he received the results of those past actions, that he was still attacked in the street, or as it describes, one of the teachings describes him coming back after his arms round with his head bleeding and his arms bowl broken. And so he had those kind of, that kind of vipaka, because he was a killer. You know, he was violent and dangerous. But the ending of karma was also that he was not making anything out of it. He wasn't resenting it. He wasn't identifying with it. It's just, well, that was the cause. This is the effect. You know, so even though those results were being felt, the karma has ended insofar as he's not creating any more reactivity around that, not creating more of a sense of self around that.
But when you say the karma, my karma is the owner of me.
You could, but I wouldn't say it like that. Say what you like, really. You could say what I think I am is heavily flavored by karma, by the actions that have been taken. Also, maybe another thing to say, because we had a lot of discussion about karma in these few days together. One of the important aspects of karma and its place in the Buddha's teaching is that what we're experiencing now is not just the results of actions that we have taken in the past. Yeah. We are, so there are what are called the five niyamas. Niyama, N-I-Y-A-M-A, niyama, is the word for law. So there are five niyamas that we experience. So what we're experiencing now is not just the results of personal choices, like that we've decided to come on this retreat, or I've decided to accept to lead this retreat, but we're also subject to the laws of physics and chemistry. Right, we experience gravity. Right, every single one of us is affected by the law of gravity. We feel the pull of the earth. Now, I had nothing to do with arranging the laws of physics. I did not decide on the weight of the electron, on the pull between, you know, one body and another, the force of gravity. That's not a personal thing, right? None of us were involved, I would suggest, arranging the weight of the proton and the neutron, how electrons work, the charge of the electron, the forces of gravity. These are not our own personal doing, but yet we experience the result of that all the time, every day. So this is called Utu-niyama, the laws of physics and chemistry that we experience the results of. The second of the niyamas is Bija-niyama. So I've been told Israel is not usually quite this cold and damp, but this is an unusual experience. A very English experience. I feel right at home. This is just what November is usually like in India, in England. Cold, grey, dank. They've got a wonderful word in the north of England, which is drich. Kind of perfectly describes this weather. Grey, wet, cold, drich. You can add that to your Israeli vocabulary. So, we have bodies. We are born. So we have biological processes that sustain our life. We breathe. We're aerobic. We respire. We need to breathe in, breathe out. We digest food, material food, to keep our bodies going. We have instincts because of our biological existence for fear, protecting our body. We have aggression, minding our space, don't touch my cushion. You know, the territorial imperative, this is my spot. I heard a number of years ago that Christopher Titmus, who many of you know very well, that he likes to stir people up, as you might have noticed. And at one retreat, this was at IMS, he tried just randomly moving people's cushions around to test the attachment process. And it caused such ripples of eye that it took so much time and effort to deal with it. Oh, forget it. Just pick your spot and stay there, you know. But moving people's space, it was too much to ask for. But that's Bija-niyama in some respects. Our instinct for territory, for procreation, sexual attraction, who's attractive, who's not attractive. Yeah, I want to be attractive to this person, I don't want to be attractive to that person. It's all it's biology. It's just the laws of the biological realm. It's not personal. And so even the kind of emotions that we feel, anger and excitement. Yeah, these are built into our biology. They're run by our hormones, and so a lot of that shouldn't be considered to be personal at all. Then the third one is Kama-niyama. So that's where personal choice, you know, how we act upon those impulses of anger or desire or excitement or fear and so on. So Kama-niyama, that's where personal choices come in. That's where, say, us being here in this hall are the direct results of our choices to sign up for this retreat and to be here. The fact that you might be expecting your supper is Bija-niyama, yeah? Because your bodies are attuned to having food at 6:15. It's now 5:30, so there might be a few little rumbles going on. That's Bija-niyama. It's not personal. It's not like, oh my goodness, I'm so greedy. You know, I'm hungry for my supper. Oh, you know, what an awful person I am. I got so many defilements. No, it's not personal at all. Yeah, I haven't had supper since 1978. So I don't have a rumbling stomach in the evening. My Bija-niyama doesn't do that because I haven't had supper for a long time. But you have, you know, you've been having supper every day at 6:15, so Bija-niyama is, okay, 5:30, get ready. That's not personal. It's where we are making choices, Kama-niyama, deciding to do something kind, deciding to do something harmful. You know, the 10,000 different personal choices, that's all the Kama-niyama area. Then Chitta-niyama is the laws of psychology. How we remember, how the mind imagines, how thoughts form, dissolve, how we create a memory, how we feel an emotion, the structure of mental activity, how the mind recognizes patterns, how it compares patterns, how memory, calculation, using letters, using numbers. All of that is chitta niyama, the laws of psychology. And that, again, is not personal. It's like your mental capacity to understand language is not a personal thing. As human beings, we're born with that. And that's how our minds work. One person's mind, I mean, it's why they have psychology departments, because they tell you, this is how this particular function works. This is how you recognize an object. This is how an after image works. This is how the mind recognizes patterns, language, numbers. This is the mechanics of it. That's not personal. It's just how the system operates. So that's chitta niyama. Also, how we concentrate the mind. How we create a mental image, how we can visualize things, or how we apply the quality of investigation, the capacity to investigate, to explore. This is all chitta niyama, the structure of mental activity. And then the fifth one is dhamma niyama, which is the most basic relationship of the aspects of the universe, the conditioned and the unconditioned realities and how they interact. So almost like the subatomic level of experience of how reality works at its most profound and complete level. And this is a sort of the domain that the Buddha doesn't talk a lot about. But that's the fifth is Dhamma Niyama, how the basic laws of reality. So of those five, only one is related to personal action. All the others are not. And so we can create a lot of problems for ourselves taking things like our body functions, our experiences of the weather, of being a human, of how our mind works. We can take it very personally, but rather and oftentimes I'm talking to people and they speak as though they actually invented anger. Like it's almost as if it didn't exist in the universe till I was born. They feel totally responsible for being angry. I'm such an angry person. How can I get rid of my anger? It's so awful. It's good to recognize that anger is unskillful if it's acted upon, but you didn't invent it. It's you got a body, you got a mind, you can feel anger. It's part of the deal. That's what comes with the whole package. It's there with the rest of the software. It's in the mix. So the fact that it arises from time to time is not personal. This is a part of birth in the human realm. Similarly, there's this kind of superstition of, this bad thing happened to me because it must have been something I did in a past life. I came on this retreat and I've got a nasty cold. It must be because, I treated someone badly in a past life. I would suggest it's possible. But it's more likely you got a cold because you got a body, and the body's breathing bacteria, and in this season a lot of other people are sneezing and coughing, and so it's not personal. But we can inflate the experiences that we have with all kinds of added meaning quite unnecessarily, and that often even difficult things that happen in our life, people say, I've got this terrible disease, and I'm so young. I must have done something awful in a past life, and this, being in my position, sort of abbot of a monastery, you're the kind of go-to person for everybody's problems. And over again, I say, well, maybe, but also, if you look at the way life works, not every person that's born has the expectation of living to be 90 years old and dying comfortably in their sleep. Nature doesn't work that way. Some people live a long time, some people live a short time. Some people have healthy bodies, some people have unhealthy bodies. You know, not to be too brutal about it, but, you know, look at the statistics. Really, it's just, this is how nature works. You know, some beings have a healthy body, some beings have unhealthy bodies. Some beings are in the, they were in the wrong place when the mouse was in the wrong place when the cat came out, so the mouse got, that mouse got caught. The other mouse that was somewhere else didn't get caught. So that I feel this is a, when we change the view and learn to look at karma in a much less personal way, then rather than assuming that some horrible things happen because of some bad karma or some wonderful things happen because, you know, wow, I must have been a really, really special person in a past life because, you know, I'm getting such good treatment now, or I'm so good looking, or, you know, I've made so much money, this is great, you know, I must have been a really wonderful person. But maybe, you know, maybe you just pick the stocks on the good day, you know. So that when we see things in a more broad fashion in this way, I feel it's much more realistic. And also, we are saying, well, seeing how we have a body, we have a mind, so it's not going to always work perfectly all of the time. That's why we have hospitals. I mean, how many doctors do we have in the room? You have doctors because bodies don't always work perfectly. That's normal. But we take it so... something so sort of serious or something that's gone terribly wrong because I've got this particular disease. So, you know, yes?
You said that Buddha spoke about suffering and how to deal with suffering. I would like to know, and there's a lot of speaking about equanimity, how to get free of suffering if my children or one of them is suffering? Because this is very painful for me, mm-hmm. Although it's not like before when I didn't practice. But what do you recommend the main practice for this pain? Because it's very, very painful.
Well, there's a few. It's interesting that in Buddhist psychology, compassion is not a state of suffering. Karuna. So the English word compassion literally means to suffer with. Com passio. From the Latin. Com is with, passio is suffering. So com passio means to suffer with. So the... but the Buddhist... the words that we have in Buddha Dhamma for compassion, karuna, is not a state of suffering. There's another word called anukampa, which means to resonate with, to empathize with. And sometimes it's translated with this sort of, in a poetic way, as to tremble for the welfare of all beings, like out of concern. But the Buddha points out that if you're practicing compassion and you suffer on the account of the suffering of others, then you're not practicing compassion in the best way. It's a sort of distorted compassion. So that's difficult for us because there was a big issue for me when I was growing up. I felt a lot. Yeah. When I was a child, I don't know if you're familiar with the Walt Disney movie Bambi. I wasn't allowed to watch that. My family, I was the youngest child, and my family, it seemed to be like a group agreement, don't let him see Bambi. Because there, you know, I would be unconsolable for weeks. Really, I actually didn't see Bambi the film until I was about 35. I mean, I wasn't avoiding it until then, but I saw it on a plane, and I thought, oh, that's why they didn't want me to see it. Because the mother deer gets killed. And when I was a little kid, they said, oh, no, he'll be in tears for weeks. Really? you know, there's this. I was very. I seem more like a kind of rough and ready type now. But I was a very sensitive child, and I really felt the suffering of others. Even watching, my mother told me the story of how they were my sisters and I were watching Heidi, the Joanna Spyri's story, which is not that painful, but there are some tender moments in it. And she said my sisters were like, you know, sitting there glued to the screen, you know, with, you know, Kina, and I was sitting there, tears pouring down my face. It's something that was moving in it. So I grew up through my teens really pained by this, by always wanting to help others. And if I couldn't help, then I always took it as my fault. I should do more. I could, you know, if only I could do more, then that would help. That would, other person or that animal would stop suffering. And the fact they continue to suffer is, it's my fault. Because I should be able to do more, and I can't. So, speaking of making it personal, I took it very personally. Then I had after I went into the monastery in Thailand, I had this very interesting encounter. I was a novice, so I was only like 21 this time. And this fellow came to visit the monastery one day, and it was rare that anybody who came could speak much English, because the monastery was in this remote part of northeast Thailand, and almost all the locals could speak no English. But this fellow was a military officer who was visiting the area, and he came to the monastery, and none of the other senior monks were around. And so I sat down and chatted with him and was showing him about the place, and we got talking, and we got onto the subject of compassion. I forget exactly how. But I said, well, I'm always trying to help others, and I feel so bad if I can't help. And he kind of gave me this look and said, why do you feel bad? And I said, well, yeah, I really want to do more. I mean, don't you feel that way? And he said, well, no. Because I know that I have confidence that if I could do more, I would do more. But I can't at this time, so I don't create more suffering about what I can't do. Because otherwise you've got two suffering beings instead of one. So, you know, I trust that I do what I can, but what I can't do, you know, I don't create suffering out of. And I was this feeling of like, what? Like, where do I put that? Like, looking for a pigeonhole to put that in. Like, and I couldn't find a place to put that, because my whole life I'd never had that. I'd never seen things in that way. And he said, yeah, if I have a bigger capacity and I could do more, I know I would. But, you know, I know I do what I can, but what I can't do, then I don't create a problem out of. And there was this kind of, you could feel something change gear, like, oh. And he wasn't trying to impress me or be clever. He was just speaking in a very straightforward way. Oh. Wow. And so that really hit me. And that, and I remembered it, you know, 35 years ago. So I remember it, and it had a big impact, because I have absolutely no idea how to do that. But I know he's right, that we can do that. And then the more I asked about it, the more that was evident in Buddha's teaching, that compassion is a radiance. Karuna is one of the Brahma Viharas. It's a divine, a sublime abiding. So that you are concerned, you're acting for the welfare of others, but you're not suffering on account of that. So for your own situation, just to begin by seeing if you can find that place of empathizing. You know the word empathy? Yeah. So, well, not of course. I mean, this isn't the English is not the first language of everybody here, even though yours might be extremely good. So empathy, to receive the suffering of another, but not to be identifying with it or taking it as your own or as your responsibility. So that's not easy to do, but it's something that we can do. Also, equanimity You know, in the chant that we do where it says, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, that's the way that the Buddha encourages us to develop equanimity. So, it might, again, it might seem a bit brutal, but the karma of having a child is that you have the experience of the mother. And the mother has an innate, bone-deep concern for her children in almost every case. That's how it is. So the karma of being a mother is this extraordinarily tight bond with those particular people that you've given birth to. That's natural. That's bija niyama. It's like a law of nature because of being a mother. In this lifetime, I'm not a mother. You know, I'm a guy. You know, but you know, maybe in past lives, you know, I and everybody else have been mothers. So this is just that sense of well, this is the karma of the mother. This is what we feel. It's like this. And even though the feeling is still there, that sense of it not being personal, but being a law of nature that we're part of, that we're experiencing, that changes the way that it sits within us. And you know, the more that we practice Dhamma, then the more that we realize that the flavor of life is bittersweet. That there's both of those flavors are almost always there. And that's the flavor of the human world, is a bittersweet flavor. And that suffering of your child, I mean, obviously I don't know any of your family dynamics or history, but I live in a family, I'm part of a family, and I lived, you know, in a community for all these years as a monk, and counseling people for a long, long time. So that way of recognizing, well, this is the experience of the mother. It's like this. You're not suppressing that feeling. You're not pretending that you like it. But in a way, it's this radical acceptance of, here it is. This is the flavor of the world. It's got this bitterness in it. And then in that acceptance, again, you're not approving of it or pretending that you like it. But then you find a bit more room to respond, to help where you can help, and to leave things alone when nothing can be done. I tend to be I tend to be a compulsive fixer. I'm always sort of jumping in to make it all right. And sometimes the kindest thing to do is to not do anything. And that's really, I find really difficult. But sometimes that can be the most helpful thing. And it's just, okay, leave this one alone. Just don't say anything yet. Yeah, leave it alone. And so that if we learn to not take things so personally and relate to those feelings that pull in the heart. I mean, again, I'm not a mother in this life, so I can't speak from direct experience. But I certainly experience other kinds of pulls. To be able to just know that, say, this is what it feels like, here it is. Then with that bit of extra spaciousness in the mix, then you'll find you're able to not be confused or reactive in doing what you can. Yes, I'm here.
I actually wanted to ask about the radical acceptance, because I find that's very, very inspiring, and I'd like to talk about that. Particularly what I'm interested in is the experience of radical acceptance and dealing with the world as it is right now, with all of the terrible problems it is, and so many judgments and angers and helplessness comes up. And I just want to be able to feel what it feels like subjectively to look at the world from radical acceptance.
Oh, good question. One of the things that it's useful to say over and over and over and over and over is that acceptance doesn't mean approval. And it does not, and peace does not mean passivity. So radical acceptance of all of the traumas of the world and the political conflicts and the struggles of society, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Catholics and the Protestants and the Theravadins and the Mahayanists and... Hey, you know, we all have our own flavors. So, as I was saying earlier to someone today, our own capacity to act is also part of the way things are. So that our when we're accepting the way things are, we're also accepting the fact that I can do something here sometimes, and accepting that doesn't mean I can therefore do nothing. It means that you can also act on that initiative, but you're acting on that initiative is much more likely to be in tune with the people around you, the situation that you're in, and doing what can be done. But also, as I was just saying in response to that other question, leaving things alone when nothing can be done. Because sometimes we're so quick to jump in and try and fix it, then we make a mess. It's like I'm the abbot of a monastery. There's about 70 people here, so this is about the average number of people that are staying in the monastery every day of the year, one way or another. So just to there's a lot of complex things going on, but I take great with a great seriousness the advice of Lao Tzu in one of his teachings. He says, governing a country is like frying a small fish. You ruin it with too much poking. You know, if you fiddle and you're arranging and you're fussing, then you ruin it. Yeah. So if you're a vegetarian, then just apply that to tofu or bean cakes or whatever. Yeah. Frying a bean cake is ruined if you poke it too much. Yeah. So running a monastery is exactly the same way. You know, you ruin it with too much poking. So part of radical acceptance is to be ready to notice when it's appropriate to poke and to make some input and do something, and appropriate when it's time to leave things alone and to just let them cook and to let people learn their own lessons, make their own mistakes, so that the and it's difficult because the very English word acceptance tends to imply passivity. So that's why it's good to explore this and work with it. So the way I like to describe it is that radical acceptance is recognizing, you know, this is the way things are. This is the way the world is right now. It's exactly this way. There are these people present, there are these conflicts in the world. It's exactly this way. You're not saying you like it or you dislike it. It's just here. This is the shape of it right now.
Say that you feel helpless, you can't do anything. This is a big mess, accepting this is exactly what is. This is how it is. Wouldn't you then want to just be compassionate? Isn't that something that can always be done?
Yes. Yeah. So let's say, for example, using it in terms of say that if we say that Tel Aviv is a symbol for well-being and happiness, just for example, and Haifa is the symbol of confusion and difficulty. Excuse me, anyone who lives in Haifa? Just random geography, you know. So so that you come to a junction in the road, so we call that the present moment. Okay, there is here we are. There's the road to Tel Aviv, there's the road to Haifa. You know, one is going to the west, the other is going to the northwest. And here we are. There are other roads as well. Here we are at the junction. You're not saying that the road to Haifa is evil and bad and wrong, or that the road to Tel Aviv is good and perfect and right. But if you want to end up at well-being and benefit, then you take a left. So it's a very pragmatic, a very utilitarian kind of... you're not saying all things, you know, goodness goes this way, is this way, and that that road is evil. It's like, well, if I... It's all, these are all roads. These are all possibilities. They're all right here, right now. It's like this. Okay, and then in that acceptance, okay, this is the way that things are arranged. Okay, let's try that road and see where it goes. And so then acting on compassion or giving ourselves towards compassion, it's like, okay, let's choose the road to Tel Aviv. That looks like a good direction. Let's head down there and see what it brings. So that you're not blaming the road or praising the road, you're just recognizing, okay, if we want to end up in that with that result, that's a good direction to head. But you need to start out with that quality of these are just roads. This is the exact way things are right now. So, am I explaining myself clear enough?
The thing is that it's so easy to say this is the way things are right now, and then feel like you're helpless.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to sort of to speak about, because it's what you do when you're that kind of acceptance, radical acceptance, is in a way you're opening your mind, your being, to all the possibilities. So that's the important thing.
If you look at everything, and this is how it is, would you be looking at it with love then, and caring, and not just sort of, this is me, this is it, this is the world, but actually you are looking at whatever it is, and wanting only to bring goodness into whatever there is?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because that's also why I use this expression, unentangled participating, rather than sort of being the watcher or being the observer. I feel that using that term participating is like, this is us. This is, I am this world. This world is me. I am it. It is me. This is, we are it. There's a belonging. And so that radical acceptance, you can also rephrase it as, it's recognizing everything belongs. The beautiful and wholesome belongs, and the ugly and cruel and destructive belongs. Yeah. The Jews belong, the Muslims belong, you know, the Christians belong, the Buddhists belong, the non-aligned. We all belong, yeah? The flies, the ants, you know, the birds, it all belongs, everything belongs. And then a total acceptance of everything belonging and us participating and being part of all that belongs. Okay, everything belongs now. Which direction is going to lead to greater benefit for myself and others? And which direction is going to lead towards harm and destruction? So it's based on that quality of belonging, of seeing that this is all just part of the natural order. And as soon as we feel it shouldn't be this way, or that doesn't really belong, or they are not really people like us, you know, them, yeah. Then it's you're starting out from a distorted position that they don't really count. They're not really people, yeah. And that we all are very aware of the terrible, you know, destruction and harm that's been done. Yeah, in Nazi Germany, that the Jewish people were, along with the Romanies and gay people, and you know, they're non-people. They're just vermin. You know, just a disease to be wiped out. It's not real. They're not people, not proper, not true. So that that kind of distortion necessarily has an awful, painful, and you know, catastrophic result. So the radical acceptance is that, and this is how I phrase it to myself, and have used it over a long time, is everything belongs, and everything that this person is. All of, not just the, you know, the wisdom and kindness and compassion, but also, you know, the confusion and lust and fear, and that all is part of it too. My capacity for violence is also part of it. But the more that is received and known, then the more you are, and there's mindfulness, there, the more that you get to know, okay, well, that's a violent impulse that belongs to the universe. That's part of the way things are. But if that's acted on, then they will suffer, I will suffer, you know, everybody loses. So let's not go down that road. And the more that we develop clear and comprehensive mindfulness, then the more those choices are open to us, so that you are able to recognize, okay, well, all these roads belong, this is all part of the network, and now where do I want to go? where are we heading? What's the destination? So then, and it's something that it takes a lot of feeling out, because we also with the Buddhist meditation, there's a lot of the conditioning around peace means no stuff going on, or peace means just watching and not being involved. So I feel it's important to, I also acknowledge this is a kind of a personal mission, to tweak that, to see that the peace is not in the absence of objects. It's not that when the call from the mosque stops, then there is peace. The peace is in how the heart receives the sound. It's not when the pain in your leg finishes, or the meditation ends. You know, peace is always in the attitude. Peace is in it's not the presence or the absence of particular objects, it's how the heart relates to those objects. So we come to a quiet place. Endor is a wonderful retreat environment. We put the odds in our favor so that non-contentious attitude can be most easily developed. But we still work with the way things are. You know, being told that people in Israel are not used to this amount of rain and cold. You've all adapted very well. Come to England sometime. Yeah. But we're not holding the retreat, you know, in the middle of the city in a park with other people coming and going. We choose our own little enclave, our contained environment, to make it a bit easier. But still, even whether you're here or whether you're in the park in the middle of Tel Aviv, you know, or in the middle of Jerusalem, it's still up to us whether we find peace or not. Because you can be, as I'm sure you will have recognized, you can be sitting here, it's totally silent, there's no pain in your body, your mind is perfectly quiet, and it's all wrong. Right? I'm not reading anybody's mind, but just, you know, past experience shows, like, I'm perfectly still, I'm comfortable, it's a perfect temperature, it's totally silent. So what? And in the other end of the spectrum, you can be in the middle of a busy street, lots of traffic, people honking their horns, and you can be sitting there, and this is fine. People are getting upset, there's lots of noise and activity and busyness. Life is perfect. So that that quality of attitude, and using the practice to consciously cultivate that attitude of non-contention, or even better, unentangled participating. And I'm looking for ways to express that with a few less syllables. But that's as kind of brief as I can make it at the moment. Unentangled participating. The more we establish mindfulness in that way, then we're fully with the world, or belonging to the world, participating in the world, but without confusion, and with the space to be able to, you know, to respond to the many ups and downs of life. We've been favoring all the people at the front, but I see a hand at the back. The woman with who's been operating the lights. Thank you very much for your light activity. So that's the important thing. It's not.
Be loving it. Like, when you can look at everything And this is how it is. Would you be looking at it with love then and caring? And not just sort of, this is me, this is it, this is the world. But actually you are looking at whatever it is and wanting only to bring your goodness into whatever there is?
Well, you kind of described it right there. often the naming of what's going on is the most important part. So just to recognize that sense of, oh, there's a feeling of me, the witness, looking at that object. That's what's happening now. That's what this dynamic feels like. There's the witnesser and the witnessed. There's the subject here and the object there. And the feeling of just watching. And then by naming what the experience is, then the mind is less entangled in it, less caught up with that. And then that sense of, oh, that doesn't feel quite right. And that subtle sense of I, the witness, or I, the watcher, then can be addressed. And also using that the kind of phrases to name that, to say me, the witness, watching, yeah, that thought over there, then by naming it, highlighting it in that way, then the mind can't believe in it and solidify it in the same way. Or the other the practices I was talking about a couple of days ago, where you use a question like, who is watching? What is it that's aware of this? And so, in a sense, you're turning the camera back onto the photographer. Like Henri Cartier-Bresson, a famous photographer, always was never letting himself be seen. It's like turning the camera to face the photographer. So, using that kind of a question, what is it that's knowing this? Who is aware? What is this that's watching? And then, by bringing the attention to that feeling of watching or witnessing, then those subtle I feelings, the identification, then can't sustain itself. It breaks up. Speaking of breaking up, there was a special request from the Cook's team to have a 5 minutes of silence at the end of this, so then the cooks can disappear and do that food thing that maybe a few stomachs are getting ready for. And so we'll just sit quietly for a few minutes, and then I'll ring the bell in five, and then the cooks can do their good work in peace.